They descended on the city, tried to send Marines inside. The people fought with rockets and wouldn't make it out alive. They'd heard what they'd done in Baghdad, they'd heard how they shot to kill. They'd heard the news from other cities, how the hospitals were filled. They'd heard from Samarra, how they come from all around. They'd formed a wall around them, how the snipers shot them down. How they'd sent the population fleeing for their lives. How they'd sweat the streets for prisoners, how they cut the water lines. Coming. It was written in the wind. City braced for murder with the army moving in. Folks rushed in with medicine to try to get supplies. Sleepless nights were spent in wonder of who would not survive. They started getting ready as the day was coming close. Mujahideen fighters took up corner posts. Some fled for other cities, the rest dug it tight. The farmers of Fallujah would not be down without a fight. November 8th, the troops came pouring in. Bombs ripped apart the houses, people fought them from within. From cluster bombs exploding, there was phosphorus gas. They were torturing their prisoners, flames were spreading fast. You couldn't walk the streets at night, a curfew was imposed. They ordered evacuations and they blocked the major roads. They were occupying houses, holding families under siege. Shooting from their windows, not letting people leave. Bombing indiscriminately, there were B-52s. They were picking off civilians, there were snipers on the roofs. They were shooting ambulances, there were bodies in the streets. There's 250,000 refugees and 100,000 people who fled have not returned. The air still thick with the smell of people's bodies left to burn. A quarter of the city blown apart by bombs. Now they're sorting through the rubble, picking up the crumbs. That was Fallujah, that was 2004. Soon Tal Afar would fall victim to the war. 3 years of slaughter, no plans to cease to line the pockets of some people back in Washington, D.C. And it was just like Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. They firebombed Dresden, how it spread from house to house. Paving through the neighborhoods, just like Janine. Giving contracts to Halliburton, just like New Orleans.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just joining us, we're listening to Does U.S. Military Intervention in the Middle East Help or Hurt? You can hear this program at 96.5 FM in the Sacramento area, or you can go to accesssacramento.org, or you can download it from greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Two things would undermine and destroy the Obama presidency, what remains of Obama's credibility. One is another consequential attack on the homeland. I'm not talking about a lone wolf-inspired attack. I'm talking about a directed attack that leads to scores of American casualties, regardless of his actions now. And the second, which three administrations have now committed themselves to, is Iran's crossing the threshold to weaponize.
Which is, and he agrees with you. He agrees with you, and that's why he is caving in the negotiations.
I'm John Donvan, and you're listening to Intelligence Squared U.S., Oxford-style debating on American shores. Stay with us. I want to remind you that we're in the question and answer section of this Intelligence Squared U.S. debate. I'm John Donvan, your moderator. We have four debaters, two teams of two, debating this motion: flexing America's muscles in the Middle East will make things worse. Let's go to some questions from the audience. Mike's coming on your right-hand side. If you could stand up, please.
My question is for the four side. Assuming practicality that the sanctions are now becoming squishy, do you think it's worse to flex American muscle than to allow the Middle East to go into a nuclear arms race?
I don't know what you mean by sanctions getting squishy. We can argue all night about sanctions that have worked in some cases and not worked in others, and there are all kinds of variables that take too much time to come into play. But I would mention just one example, and we've cited it in other ways in the past. Libya, that was a successful use of sanctions against Gaddafi, and he made this tremendous turn away from his previous outrageous behavior with regard to his unconventional weapons programs, weapons of mass destruction, and his rampant involvement in international terrorism. And back in the 1990s, after several years of multilateral sanctions, in which he felt both the economic hurt and the political hurt of being a pariah, he changed. He got out of the international terrorism business, and he opened up and gave up his unconventional weapons program. And that was all without use or even the threat of military force. That was a successful case.
That's a fanciful chronology. He gave up his weapons program after a massive application of American force in 2003. It was the example of the invasion of Iraq that turned him. It was also the invasion of Iraq that compelled the Iranians to stop their weaponization
I know it is wrong because I was personally involved in the negotiations with the Libyans back in 1999.
I was personally involved in the negotiations to delist the Libyans.
Mike, wait, we've got some real insiders here. Mike, Paul,
Gaddafi made those decisions in the 1990s. When I sat down across the table from his intelligence chief, he had already decided to get out of the unconventional weapons programs and get out of international terrorism. That was 4 years before.
Mike Duran.
His intelligence chief, Musa Kusa, was his name. Great name, yeah, Musa Kusa. Musa Kusa once had a beautiful villa overlooking the Mediterranean. And he came home one day to his villa, and it was turned into rubble, bulldozed into nothing. And there was a message for him that the leader wants to see you. And so he went to go see the leader. And the leader said, Musa, that villa. And he said, yes. He said, I didn't like it. It wasn't right for you. And he handed him some keys, and he said, I've built another villa for you, and I want you to have that. And he gave him this other villa. And so what was the message? The message was, don't get too big for your britches. Everything you've got comes from me, and I can destroy you in an instant. That's the mentality of a leader in the Middle East. And you got to ask yourself, if that's who we're dealing with, do we deal with them with soft power or do we deal with them with hard power?
All right, let's go to another question, sir.
I'm Alex El-Fakir. I'm a student at Princeton University, and thank you for having me here this evening. Mr. Pillar and Mr. Miller, your point of only fighting smart wars is well taken. However, military force is not bound to times of war. How can the United States effectively influence the perceptions, calculations, actions, and goals of its adversaries, particularly those who only deal in terms of violence, without a muscular foreign policy? Thank you.
I think that as long as you calculate means and ends, and that in effect military power, the projection of it, is an instrument to serve a set of political goals, then military power can be an effective tool. What do you do, however, in a situation like Egypt, where in effect they are an ally, former ally, still our ally? We have a freedom agenda. We want to promote democracy in a country that since the overthrow of Mubarak, has been dominated by a struggle between the military on one hand and the Islamists on the other. We have to be artful and relatively sophisticated. My basic point is, in a region in turmoil, it's simply going to be very difficult to create an action-reaction phenomenon. That's why I go back to the notion of understanding what our core interests are, identifying them, and then trying to protect them.
Let me go to this side, because Aaron has made that point a few times about core interests. He's been pretty clear about them, but you had us rescuing Yazidis in Syria, and we didn't really get very far with the question. I don't want to delve into it too much, but what are our core interests in terms of using force?
Well, one thing is we don't want to allow genocide to happen against a helpless population of women and children starving and trapped on a mountain.
So that is a core interest?
Yes. Well, that is a core democratic value, I would say, and we are a country where values do often coincide.
Let me stop you and ask the other side. Is that a core interest?
Look at our behavior. How can you argue it's a core interest? Well, we are incredibly hypocritical when it comes to humanitarian intervention. We decide what is feasible, what is convenient, and we essentially ignore the tough cases. Bill Clinton, to this day, and the late Fuad Ajami called him to count. This is your Rwanda, President Obama.
So you're saying these are not core interests, you're saying?
I mean, look, our interests...
I'm just looking for clarity.
Know, you're looking for a short answer, I understand.
No,
that. I
yes or no
that.
Is a short...
Our interests and our values and our policies are constantly at war with one another. On the issue of genocide, we have not been consistent.
Brett?
I was just going to say we're a country that, in a sense, is unique in that we often find ourselves defining our interests by our values rather than the other way around. And by the way, a reputation for being a humane hegemon is good for us in the long run. It allows us to maintain a Pax Americana in the way that the Russians were not able to maintain a Soviet peace in their sphere of influence, because at some level, countries around the world understand that we operate differently from the Iranians, the Chinese, and the Russians. And it's what makes countries want to be our allies, our friends, our trading partners. So yes, we do have an interest in making sure when we can tip the scales at relatively low cost to ourselves that we shouldn't allow atrocities to happen. That's not the kind of country we were born to be. And I think this is a common sense proposition all of you would agree with.
Copperhead Road. I'm not a DA, he's got a chopper in it.
And now, back to the debate. Does U.S. military intervention in the Middle East help or hurt?
In the back, they're wearing a necktie. Thanks.
Hi, my name is Kaz Joshi. Mike constructed a brilliant structure to think about the impact, one where whether it stops any good process and whether it generates any bad process in the future. Could you talk a little bit about what your thoughts are about what are the bad processes that that the military intervention would generate that you don't think it would?
Wait, so you're saying what are the bad consequences of inaction?
No, I think I got him. He was saying what are some of the bad things that our action could generate? Is that what you're saying?
But why would you want this side to believe that this side would want to give you all that ammunition?
I can answer that.
Okay.
I can answer it. Look, the problem that you have is that we can never know the future. So it's always a question of are the risks of inaction worse than the risks of action? And so that's why I argued that we should have a bias toward action, because lack of action destroys our alliances. And if we desire to keep this region at a distance, then we have to persuade other actors on the ground to take action in order so that we don't have to go in unilaterally.
I don't think our foreign policy ought to be biased one way or the other, toward action or toward inaction. It ought to be an unbiased weighing of costs and benefits and weighing of those core interests that we were talking about a moment ago, and not come at it with a preconception that we ought to be acting more than enacting or the other way around.
And that concludes round two of this Intelligence Squared U.S. debate, where our motion is flexing America's muscles in the Middle East will make things worse. On to round three, closing statements. First, summarizing his position in support of the motion, flexing America's muscles in the Middle East will make things worse, Paul Piller, a senior fellow at the Center for Security Studies at Georgetown and former national security officer.
You know, we Americans have an awful lot of faith in our ability to do great things overseas. It is well-founded faith, because we have done some great things, including with the use of military force, like Brett mentioned earlier in his opening remarks. World War II is probably the best example of all. But some things, even we, the superpower, can't do, even with our military might. I've served in the U.S. military and in a foreign conflict. In my case, it was as an Army officer in the Vietnam War. That war was an extremely painful lesson to us, the American people, about the limitations of what we can do with military force. And among the bad consequences it had was, getting to the issue of credibility, it reduced the credibility that the U.S. would use that military instrument in other better ways because of the American people's reaction to what had happened. Enough years went by and we finally got over what happened and what we called the Vietnam syndrome. And one way we demonstrated we got over it was another thing that Brett mentioned, the splendid victory in the Middle East, reversing Saddam Hussein's aggression against Kuwait in 1991. But the problem is, since then, we've been thinking more and doing more of using military force not just to reverse someone else's aggression, like in World War II or Operation Enduring Freedom. We got into other things, changing regimes we didn't like, or taking part in someone else's civil war, or trying to inject democracy through the barrel of a gun. Leadership is not just flexing muscle, it is having the wisdom to know the limitations and the costs and the risks, and most of all, to follow the Hippocratic principle of first, do no harm.
Thank you, Paul Piller. The motion is flexing America's muscles in the Middle East will make things worse, and here to summarize his position against this motion, Brett Stevens, a foreign affairs columnist and member of the editorial board at the Wall Street Journal.
For the last few years, the United States has conducted precisely the kind of diplomacy and geopolitical strategy that Paul Piller has spent this evening advocating. We have focused on nation building at home. We have had a president who has told us time and again that the tide of war is receding. We've had a president whose bias, generally speaking, has been toward inaction, not action. We have had an administration that believes that the best course for the United States is to reduce its footprint, particularly in the Middle East, to pivot away from that region, to look at Asia, to look at our own problems at home. with the idea that in so doing, that region would perhaps sort out its own problems and affect us less. And yet the reality is exactly the opposite of what we have seen. A RAND Corporation study showed that the number of jihadists in the Middle East, of jihadi groups and jihadi fighters, more than doubled between 2010 and 2014, precisely during the time that the Obama administration was saying the tide of war is receding, and precisely during the time that we were essentially following the counsel of our opponents on the other side of the stage. We have not made the world go away. We have not made the world a safer place. The world is more dangerous today than it was a few years ago. Machiavelli once said, the best policy is to be a firm friend and a thorough foe. For the last few years, we have been neither. We have to change that, or we will imperil our security here in New York.
Thank you, Brett Stevens. And the motion is, flexing America's muscles in the Middle East will make things worse. Here to summarize his position in support of the motion, Aaron David Miller, Vice President for New Initiatives at the Wilson Center and former U.S. Mideast negotiator.
Thanks, John. And Mike and Brett, I appear with you guys all the time. We have to do this again. Two days before the Camp David summit, President Clinton remarked to us, he knew the odds were long, that trying and failing was better than not having tried at all. And I remember how inspired I was by his remarks. I began to understand that trying and failing is better than not trying at all is an appropriate slogan for a high school college football team. It is not a substitute for a foreign policy of the most consequential nation on earth. We need to think before we act, and we need to understand above all that the dividing line for a smart foreign policy is not between left and right, not between liberal and conservative. It's between smart on one hand and dumb on the other. And the only question that you have to decide, and I implore you to vote for this motion, because I think our arguments have struck the right balance between risk readiness on one hand, risk aversion on the other. A clear definition of when U.S. military power and its projection is important and vital, and when it is not. Three questions need to be asked. Number one, what are we trying to achieve by deploying military force? Number two, do we have the means at our disposal to accomplish our ends? And number three, above all, what will it cost? You ask those questions, you're firm and resolute, and American interests can be protected.
Thank you, Aaron David Miller. Our motion is flexing America's muscles in the Middle East will make things worse. Here to summarize his position against this motion, Mike Doran. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and former senior director at the National Security Council.
Paul would have us believe that we can stay back, sit back away from the region, and not be involved in the sectarian fight on the ground. And it's simply not true. I once had a good friend who went on the Peace Corps to Tuvalu, little Pacific nation, and I found out that the people of Tuvalu were very angry with us because we had come up with some fishing regulations that destroyed their economy. Of course, nobody in America even knew that we did this. It's the same thing in the Middle East. We are judged by our action, and we are judged by our inaction. And we are participants by the nature of our size and our historic role in the Middle East, in the sectarian conflict, in all of the conflicts in the region, whether we think we are or not, whether we stay out or whether we don't. So the question is not whether to intervene or not to intervene, it's how to shape what's going on there. And the most important resource that we have in order to keep us from having to have massive interventions like the kind that we had in Iraq in 2003 is to build up our alliances. And the only way we can build up our alliances is by providing security to our friends. And that's why we have to use military force so that we will not have the kind of wars that Paul wants to prevent.
Thank you, Mike Doran. And that concludes our closing statements. And now it's time to learn which side has argued best. Okay, so it's all in. I have the final results. The motion is this: flexing America's muscles in the Middle East will make things worse. That was the motion. And before hearing the debate, our live audience here in New York voted this way. 26% agreed with the motion. 31% were against. 43% were undecided. That's a large figure for us. So those are the first results. Remember, now you have voted a second time, and the winner is the team whose numbers have changed the most in percentage point terms from the first vote to the second. So let's go to the second vote. On the motion, flexing America's muscles in the Middle East will make things worse, the team arguing for the motion, their second vote was 45%. percent. That's 26% to 45%. They picked up 19 percentage points. That is the number to beat. The team arguing against the motion, their first vote 31%, second vote 45%. They pulled up 14 percentage points. It's not quite enough. The team arguing for the motion wins our debate. That is flexing America's muscles in the Middle East will make things worse. Our congratulations to them, and thank you for me, John Donvan, and Intelligence Squared.
And so once again, my dear Johnny, my dear friend, and so once again, you are fighting us all. And when I ask you why, you raise your sticks and cry, and I follow my friend. How did you come to trade the fiddle for the drum? You say I have turned like the enemies you've earned, but I can remember all the good things you are. And so I ask you please, can I help you find the peace and the star, oh my friend? What time is this to trade the handshake for the fist? And so once again, oh America, my friend, and so once again, you are fighting us all. And when we ask you why, you raise your sticks and cry, and we follow, my friend. How did you come to trade the fiddle for the drum? You say we have turned like the enemies you burned, but we can remember all the good things you are. And so we ask you, please, can we help you find the peace and the star? Oh, my friend, we have all come to fear the beating of your drum.
And now, messages from Access Sacramento.